House Water Committee this 10th, I think, day of April. We have a hopefully full agenda for us as we look at this morning's activities, and we now have a quorum. So without other instructions or recommendations from committee staff, we will proceed on schedule and start with House Bill 3519.
House Bill 3519 requires the Director of Division of State Lands to require complaints regarding removal or filling activities within waters of the state to be in writing. Requires investigation of complaint to determine whether the complaint is groundless or made for purposes of harassment. Allows the director to seek civil penalties for complaints that are groundless or made for purposes of harassment. Director of Division of State Lands to report to legislature, legislative review agency on damages awarded against division or on numbers of employees. This has not gotten, we don't have a physical, there's no revenue, but it does, could potentially have a physical. We haven't heard from that, but that might be a possibility.
Okay, and we are probably going to get a little disjointed on 3519, folks, because Representative Anderson will want to be down and testify and explain a little bit on that. But I do note that we have the department here, and I have Jeanette signed up to inform us about what this bill is and why she's fallen in love with it.
Mr. Chair, we have amendments to this bill, and they are out there, and members should have copies of them.
Okay, we have amendments to the bill.
Hi, Bob.
Good morning. And would you, before Jeanette begins, would you enlighten us as to what the amendments or amendments are?
Okay, I can do that. I find my copy of them. The amendments to the bill eliminate the sentence on the first page, line 2, eliminates all of the sentence for that sentence after 196890. Basically, because that portion that relates to that is going to be made temporary. Later on in the bill, on page 2, line 2, the $200 penalty, civil penalty, has been changed to $500. And section 5 has been made in a part of section 4. It becomes section 4. Division of State Lands shall report annually. Shall report annually to the Legislative Committee. As what that section does, and also sunsets that reporting as of January of 2008.
Okay.
The rest of the bill goes away.
Ms. Holman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm the Assistant Director for Administration and Finance at the Division of State Lands. At this time, the Division of State Lands is neutral on this bill. We have a number of questions about the bill and would like more clarification before we take a position on the bill. Let me tell you a couple of those concerns or questions that we have. First of all, we're not quite sure what the intent of the bill is or what the problem is the bill's attempting to address. On its face, it appears to be aimed at reducing frivolous complaints that result in needless enforcement activities. But the new language in Section 4 seems to be aimed at the division on the basis that a substantial number of lawsuits are brought against the division that result in punitive and actual damages. At this time, neither of these circumstances are occurring, and so the bill does appear to address something that doesn't exist at this time. in implementing Section 2 of the bill, it would be useful to have more clarity about the type and amount of information that would be necessary for a complaint to be considered a detailed written record that the division could investigate as they're required to do in subsection 1 of that section. Third, in subsection 2 of section 2, the director may refuse to consider a future complaints from a person if the director has reason to believe the complaint was groundless or made for purpose of harassment. There's no clear standards for criteria for making that determination, and often when a determination is made about whether a violation has occurred requires pretty technical expertise as well as a close scrutiny of not only the DSL statutes and rules but also local government regulations, sometimes individual water rights certificates or permits, and other kinds of legal documents. To an untrained observer, a violation may appear to have occurred, but when the division investigates it, it's actually not a violation. Under this provision, that complaint could be deemed to be groundless or for the purpose of harassment. So for us, it's extremely important to have really clear language setting forth the basis for making such a determination, and that's especially important because a civil penalty could be imposed if the director makes such a finding. Finally, in subsection 5, the bill, well, and this is language that is replaced by the amendments, the requirement to report on budget information is already standard operating procedure and part of the budget process, but it's my understanding that's amended out in the dash one amendment. So you were questioning whether there's a fiscal impact. At this point, we wouldn't see a fiscal impact with this bill. Thank you. And I'd be glad to answer questions or get Mr. Purchase here.
Somehow I'm a little confused. I thought you were going to come and tell us what you know, why you love this book.
Well, I didn't say I hated it yet. I just need some clarification.
And I didn't get any real reason from you as to why you loved it. I have some questions, but let me stop and ask the committee if they have some questions or concerns. Representative Shockley.
Thank you. So, if I get your message right, you don't think it's necessary, but I don't really hear that it's really going to do any harm either.
Well,
I've got the potential for harassment, but isn't this, I assume that the intent of this was to avoid harassment, so can you clear that up for me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, well, that's a little bit of what I'm not clear about and that I would look for clarification. It looks like it may be aimed at some of the neighbor-to-neighbor disputes that sometimes we get reported to us and we have to deal with because somebody reports a violation that isn't really a violation as a way to deal with a neighbor that they don't like what they're doing. But the second part of the bill appears to be aimed at what would appear to be, I mean, the only reason I would see an agency to have punitive damages assessed against it would be if they're the one that's harassing someone, and that hasn't happened. So it's not, I'm not, the two pieces don't seem to fit together, and I mean, we need some clarification about what the intent is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeanette. You raised actually almost all the questions that I had in your testimony. However, there were just a couple. I mean, I was perplexed when I read through this about why we had this bill in front of us because, as you mentioned, I
can answer that question for you very simply. Because the chair likes the bill.
Oh, that explains.
So the second part, as you said, you already do. The first part, the concern I had, and I see that this is a request at the request of a particular constituent, and I am very concerned about the intimidation, potential intimidation factor, saying if somebody calls and says they have a complaint about, like you said, their neighbor or somebody down the street, and that we may, now, currently, I guess my question is, regards to Section 2, Subsection B, it would be hard for me to believe that you already don't make some detailed record of complaint. I mean, aren't you currently required to do that? I just don't know if it's as far as anonymous. I think that's really what I need a clarification on, because I know, and I've been in that situation before where, you know, you talk to people and they say, well, there's something going on, but I don't want my name there because I don't want it, my neighbor to know it was me or whatever, and I'm concerned about the potential intimidation factor with this bill, so maybe you can address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I'm going to get Steve up here, who actually looks at these complaints more often than I do, but my understanding is that, I mean, yeah, we would definitely have something in writing to indicate that someone had called or something, but whether that would be considered a detailed written complaint, I don't know. Steve, do you want to tell them what we do have?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. Representative Dingfelder, let me try to address your question. A typical process for us is someone calls us on the phone to report a complaint or a possible violation. We have a form that we fill out to get as much information from the person reporting the complaint as we can get, location, what they think they've done, who the person is, their phone number, if we can get that so we can call the individual and find out what they're really doing. And it's a basic one-page piece of paper that gives us a lot of information about what we think we're hearing. And then that gives us a chance to call an individual and find out if there's really a violation or what's going on. The person who calls us, we keep them confidential because of the issue that you raised, concerns about harassment from the neighbors. It's not unusual for us to find ourselves right smack in the middle of a neighbor dispute that we're trying to resolve in order to find out if there's been a violation. So we do that quite a bit.
Okay, thank you. And I actually, you addressed...
Follow-up,
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
You actually addressed all the other questions I had. I am concerned about the discretionary aspect of this, where it says the director may refuse to consider future complaints. Mm-hmm. I guess, again, that's the definition of harassment, and so that's some concerns I had about that. Thank you.
That generates a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Chopper?
Thank you. If the director may decide not to follow up on any more complaints, I would assume that would be after repeated complaints that were checked out, found to be not real problems. Now, are there some rules that are some kind of process in the process that, I mean, you just can't say, well, I'm not going to check that out. That's what I share her Representative Dinkmelder's concerns, but surely there must be some process in writing that would allow the director to do that. Am I correct in assuming that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffner, we look at every complaint that comes in because we're required to do that. And we take the notes, and it's not unusual for us to get individuals or groups who make a number of complaints on an annual basis. You know, after you work with a group for a while or with a individual for a while, you pretty quickly learn kind of what their issue is and what they're really trying to do. If it's a neighbor dispute and it's neighbor to neighbor and we've not been able to solve one of the parties' issues, either we got the activity stopped or we simply find no violation but we continue to get the same complaint over and over, we just simply try to deal with that as best we can and assure both parties that it's a fair and objective review of the activity to determine if it's a violation. If it's not a violation, it's not a violation.
May I follow up, please? It is germane.
Thank you, Jennifer.
We just we're looking at complaint fee in the contractor's board, and the prevailing party may get their fee returned. It should say shall, I think. But it sounds like maybe we should do that in the future here, too. If somebody's making frivolous complaints, at least you would get rid of the frivolous complaints. Someone who's serious has a serious complaint, if we ask them to pay $100 or $50 to file it, that would avoid... And do you think that would... My question is, do you think that would avoid this stuff? Or is that a wrong way to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffner, I think I would be concerned that those folks would see that as a form of intimidation by itself.
Well, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Kerr. Actually, the complaints can be a form of intimidation by themselves also. Right. So, you know, I joined the chair in really liking this bill. And you know, to get to what Representative Schaffer was talking about, I guess, I mean, you can see patterns develop, and you guys know that as well as anybody else. And I guess for the agency to have the ability to not have to go out and do all of the detail work when it's, you know, because you get times when you will have a group that are kind of attacking an individual or a business, and you know the pattern, and for you to be able to kind of short circuit that is, I think, appropriate, because you're not, you know, you're putting in a lot of time and a lot of effort for a known result sort of thing. But I was a little concerned, Jeanette was questioning the punitive damage part of it, but this is just reporting. So, if you aren't assessing punitive damages, you just report. You're not assessing punitive damages.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, two things. Let me clarify.
Okay.
I think that the concern about the complaint that occurs over and over is that just we need some criteria or some kind of definition of what harassment is, so that we can say, you know, to this person that, you know, we see this as a frivolous complaint because we've received 10 complaints just like it from you in the last 6 months or something like that. The other part is my understanding is what the bill is asking for is for punitive damages that are assessed against the agency. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that doesn't make sense to me, because the rest of the bill is dealing with punitive this problem of someone filing a complaint that really is groundless, but the damages appear to be assessed against the agency. And that doesn't happen. I mean, it hasn't happened.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, maybe if we are setting in, well, so if it doesn't happen, this.
What? I mean, the reporting part is not.
I mean, I don't see that as a big thing one way or the other myself, but, you know, I have no problem with putting it there. You know, if it's not happening, it's not happening. There's nothing to report. Back to your first point. So are you wanting, I would assume that if this passes, that what you would do as an agency in rulemaking is set up criteria that would say, you know, if X, Y, and Z, then we aren't gonna pursue any more complaints. Isn't that, or are you looking for that sort of criteria in statute? I mean, I think you guys know when, you know, when a duck's a duck and when a duck turns into a goose. You guys know that. So I'm assuming that would be something that you would establish so there's clear and defined standards for the decision not to pursue a complaint, wouldn't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, you know, our experience has been is if we were to get to a litigious type situation, I would think it would be better if we had it in statute, simply because it's easier for us to defend rather than administrative rule. Administrative rule goes through a public review process, and while the intent of the legislature may be for us to do that, when you go to public rulemaking and take public comment, you sometimes get a different public perception of what the legislature intended. So I guess my request would be for some very clear legislative direction on that.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Do you know what that should be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I haven't worked on that, no, but okay, we can do something.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, I don't want to presume to be the one to set the standards for the agency as to when they can make the determination that this is not a case that should be pursued because there's been, this person has done five others, or there's kind of a class action sort of thing going, you know, like all the neighbors have organized and are doing one complaint after another to keep things tied up. I think it's justifiable that we have something like this in process. So, but and if the agency wants it in statute, I have no problem with that. I just don't know what they'd be. So,
well, happy to provide the statute.
So, I mean, I guess I'd request that they see what they can come up with as far as the standards, and that we review that.
I'm sure Jeanette will be happy to help us with that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Tolman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I apologize for being late, and maybe this question was already answered, but I'm wondering, how often does this situation arise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tolman, we receive about 2,000 complaints on an annual basis.
Wow.
You know, I have not gone back and searched how many times we get the same complaint from individuals, but it does happen occasionally. You simply get a neighbor feud, and then one neighbor is not going to be satisfied until, you know, we do something punitive against the other neighbor, or, you know, it does happen, but I don't have a number off the top of my head.
Okay. I'm going to follow up. Okay. Monthly? Once a year? I mean, I know you can't come up with a number. Any kind of a guess? I mean, I guess I'm trying to get a sense on how big a problem this is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomey, we get, as I said, mentioned, about 2,000 complaints on an annual basis. Not all those turn into violations, but we do look at every one. So you're looking at, 25, well, let's see, if I do the math here, right, about 150, 175 a month.
Wow.
So it's a number per week.
So it keeps us busy.
It's not unusual, particularly in a high development area where there's lots of activity going on, to get a number of complaints about a single project.
Right.
And, you know, housing development projects get a lot of complaints from neighbors and interest groups and what have you. So I could go back and look at that if you would like a number.
No, I'm just trying to get in my mind. I mean, it's a bigger problem than I'd assume. May I follow up?
Before you follow up, let me make an observation that some of us who represent rural districts find that as far as constituent issues, this is one of the more frequent constituent issues that we encounter.
The constituent being the developer, the constituent being the complainant?
But we don't have to be developers in this. We can have a neighbor to neighbor, a farmer to farmer sort of thing.
So,
and so it's something that appears with quite some regularity, at least as far as
like what I'm asking.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, is so the call that you get, is it from the person who is being complained against?
Yes,
not the complainer.
No.
Okay. And I have one more question,
sure,
if I may. So if I'm, and this does happen, if I'm in my boat going along the river and I see something that looks like a violation and I call and complain about this, but perhaps it's as sometimes happens, there's a huge developer who has unlimited bucks who, if they wanted to sue me for complaining, I would be in very dire straits. So would this bill put me in jeopardy if I were to make that complaint and it turned out that it was unfounded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, excuse me, on the way the bill is drafted now, I think you could be potentially precluded from making a further complaint because it says if a complaint is found to be groundless. So, and that's why I would ask for clarification about what does groundless mean. Now, you would not necessarily be, your name under our current situation would not necessarily be given to that developer. So you could be protected that way, but you may be precluded from making future complaints.
You have a boat?
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you very much. We've got Representative Anderson here, who is the original sponsor of this bill. And I'm not sure whether Representative Anderson will recognize it after the chair got through with his proposed amendments to it. So,
looks good to me.
Thank you, Representative, for coming down. We appreciate it. We were forced to start this bill a little early because it was the only folks we had here to testify on bills.
And, sorry to be late.
Oh, you're not late. You're here right on time as per your instructions from the chair. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gordon Anderson, state representative from House District 3, serving Grants Pass and the Illinois Valley. House Bill 3519 was born of a constituent request to limit frivolous complaints regarding fill and removal activities. The bill requires any person making a complaint, excuse me, I think we have printed material. Can we get that to the committee? The bill requires any person making a complaint regarding fill and removal activities to be in writing, and for the Division of State Lands to make a determination as to whether or not the complaint was made for purposes of harassment. If DSL finds that the complaint was made for purposes of harassment, the Division may refuse to consider any future complaints made by the same complainant. In addition, it allows that filers of frivolous complaints can be fined by the Division up to $200, which is in float right now. Imagine that you and your neighbor have a long-standing dispute. He hates white barns, and you have the audacity to paint your barn white. Your neighbor is irrational and difficult to deal with, and you're unable to work to resolve the dispute. Then suppose your neighbor comes up with a great idea. He decides to call a regulatory agency and tell them that you are violating the conditions of your fill and removal permit, hoping to harass you with the trouble that comes with complying with such an investigation. Whether or not the complaint has merit, complying with the investigation could require a great investment of time and money, particularly when you factor in the fines associated with permit violation, which are up to $10,000 per day. Currently, there is no prescribed process for dealing with these types of complaints. This bill would correct that problem, and perhaps your neighbor would think twice before making a false complaint. There are criminal penalties for making a false police report. Why not have a civil penalty for making a false report of this kind? The bill also requires DSL to report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means on a biennial basis. As a part of that report, the agency would have to list the amount of damages awarded to the plaintiffs against the agency. They would then have to justify why the budget of the agency should not be reduced by that amount. This is to attempt to ensure good stewardship on the part of the division. Additionally, the bill requires the division to justify its allotted positions, with the Ways and Means Committee looking at any frivolous prosecutions the division might have undertaken. The motivation for this is to encourage the committee to ask whether or not the positions used in such a frivolous prosecution by the division should perhaps be eliminated. If a person in the private sector got his or her company sued based on some type of malfeasance, it can be assumed that the person's employment would likely be terminated. While this bill will not bring the state agencies to parity with the private sector, it will get the Ways and Means Committee to be thinking along these lines. The bill does not attempt to single out DSL. Rather, it starts small, looking at one agency, and asks whether or not this approach might bring a more cautious, more reasoned approach to enforcing land use law. If this program is effective in reducing frivolous complaints and prosecutions, perhaps future legislatures could consider expanding this legislation to cover other regulatory agencies. Thank you for your interest and attention.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for the representative? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Gordon, I'm just glancing at your, and I was.
I interrupted, and it was my fault.
You distracted me. But you're talking about frivolous complaints, And do you have experience in those frivolous complaints?
I have constituents who have had experience with that.
If I may follow up, could you just give us a brief example of that, please?
Well, where a person is basically on a river, and a neighbor has gotten in the way in terms of getting any resolution of stream flow that is flowing out on his property. We have a dairy farm in Grants Pass, and in terms of flood time, the farmer has had his fields flooded quite badly, and there's complaints any time he makes a move to try and resolve that by changing stream flow or filling or removing any gravel to make the flow go away from the fields and stay in the stream bed. He's had problems with folks. That's one that comes to mind.
Okay, if I may follow up, please. So you mentioned frivolous prosecutions. So you seem to be saying that this division is frivolously prosecuting some of these complaints.
It's a harassment, mostly.
Harassment on, if I may follow
up. On the part of the complainant.
But it sounds like if I'm reading this correctly, your intent is to punish the division as well as the complainant. Is that correct?
No, I'm asking that the division assess these complaints, and if they are for harassment purposes, just throw them out instead of letting them go on through the chain. Then if in fact the department, in this case DSL, were to forward that complaint and carry it through, and it costs the party who is really not at fault, costs them money, then there ought to be some reasonable action taken against those employees or persons, members of the DSL or any department that are not really allowing the complaint to be dealt with in a reasonable fashion.
Follow up.
Yes.
I'm having trouble getting my mind around this. It seems to me that they don't have much of a choice if a complaint is made, that they need to look into it.
This is giving the department the ability to say that's really not a reasonable complaint.
But in order to my follow-up, then...
Follow-up.
Thank you. But they have to study it in order to see if it's a frivolous complaint.
Certainly. Certainly. Study is not the problem.
If I follow up.
Yes.
Last time. But it seems like what you're saying here is if they follow it up and it's frivolous, that they are at fault and they should be punished.
No. If they follow it up and it's frivolous, they push it off the desk and it isn't further, it continued any further.
Okay.
Now, if they do continue it and carry it out and it creates harassment for a property owner, for instance, at that point in time, some departmental record of where these issues are going, are they being settled in favor of the property owner or the harasser? That we're saying there ought to be some record determined, and every 6 months there'll be a report made. These are the cases. This is how they were determined. And if this gives the Ways and Means a chance to see, is DSL really doing their job well, or are they taking one side or another?
Last follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think you weren't...
You said that last time.
I said that last time. I lied.
It's okay. You don't have to say last. Just follow-up is sufficient. We will accept the follow-up. Thank you.
I think maybe you hadn't come in yet, but we heard that there were 2,000 complaints a year.
Maybe five of those might be harassments.
Okay.
I'm just picking up.
They couldn't come up with a figure, but that just seems that that's a huge amount of complaints that they're having to deal with, and it seems like we're asking them to do even more work in determining whether or not these are frivolous. Am I
Well, I would take the position that if there are 2,000 complaints, that maybe we need to look at it and really need to evaluate where are these complaints coming from. Are they valid complaints? Are they invalid complaints? Are they harassment or are they valid, healthy complaints to maintain the stream bed or the water, the river bed?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Representative Toffler.
Thank you. Hi, Representative Anderson. You know, if there are frivolous complaints, why not just ask $50 filing fee for a complaint? I think that would stop the frivolity immediately because people who can just pick up their phone and complain will do it all day long. But if you ask them for $50 and if they prevail, they get it back. Would you be interested in it?
I'd certainly be open to looking at different ways. How do you feel about the evaluation?
I agree with the intent here, absolutely.
Okay.
But
I'm certainly open to, we were going to do some work on this prior to the work session. And
okay. I agree with the intent. People love to complain, sometimes for no reason, but if you get a neighbor thing going, I've seen personally how bad that can get, but I think the way to stop people from doing anything is frivolous, that is. I don't want people to stop complaining if they have a valid complaint. But if no one will spend $50 on a frivolous complaint. Nobody will. And if they want to just pour $150 into the Division of State Lands every time they pick up the phone, that's fine with me. But see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Anderson. Appreciate
thank
your
you.
Appreciate taking time out of your schedule to come down and be with us on this. Give us, your thoughts and ideas and where the issue kind of came from. We will be coming back to look at this bill. We are going to work with Ms. Holman and see if we can't come up with maybe some statutory language, since the department maybe prefers statutory to rule language on some of these things. And then we'll have a chance to, maybe move ahead. I'd also be interested in working with you on the amendments that the chair has proposed.
Yes.
And we'll understand these were the chair's amendments, not Representative Anderson's amendments.
Right.
So with that, let me just make a comment or two as you prepare to, look at this again. First of all, as I read the bill, there is the confidentiality issue is not in question. There's nothing that I see in the bill that says that the department is obligated to reveal.
That would concern
that material sort of thing. So, an individual who is worried about having their name, that is not. And I appreciate that. People don't sometimes like to do that. So that is protected, at least, and it would be my intention, if we haven't gotten the bill written that way, to ensure that it is written that way, that confidentiality is protected. The other thing you would make note that virtually everything on page 2 of the original bill, from line 3 on, is eliminated by the amendment that we have proposed in front of us. Now, Representative Anderson may want to bring back some of that as I talk with him, but the amendment that you have before you eliminates everything from line 3, page 2, to the end of the bill. And then it does substitute section 4, adds a section 4 and does do a section 5. The section 5 is just a sunset provision on the bill to see whether it's something we like or whether we don't like. And section 4 has to do with the penalty and or reporting. So we've tried to make it maybe a little simpler, and if we can get some of the language worked out with the department, and maybe judging from and hearing some of your issues as you've talked about them today, consider those. We can have something that's fairly clean here. So with that, with nothing further, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3519 and proceed on to open a public hearing on House Bill 2688. And thank you again, Representative Anderson.
House Bill 2688 allows use of material removed from navigable streams for certain purposes without payment of royalty. There may be a physical on this one. We have not received any comments from that. There is a notice of no potential revenue impact.
Good evening.
Okay. Do we have a...
No,
we don't. I guess I would have just said it. Okay. On this, we have Mr. Armstrong from the Port Commission, Oregon Ports Group, and Pete Williamson from the Port of St. Helens. And if my reading of these hieroglyphics is correct, it looks like they may have all been written by the same person with purchase from the...
They were my hand, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for the sloppiness. So,
and it's... Thank you. Therefore, we've got all of you here, and who wants to lead off on?
I'll go ahead and start off, Mr. Chair. I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. House Bill 2688, and I believe you've got dash one amendments. It represents a fairly long and arduous process between the ports and Division of State Lands, and I'm pleased to report that that we all sit here before you today in joint support of this bill. There's no known opposition. The purpose of the bill was to clarify what has traditionally been ambiguous statutory and administrative rule language that, in fact, has resulted in several years of litigation between some of the ports, specifically Port of Portland, and the Division of State Lands. What we tried to do during the interim was come together and say, okay, can we find a way to deal with reaching some agreement on getting clarification on the statutory language regarding when royalties are due for the use of dredged material and when royalties are not due. We have had many, many work group meetings between the division and the ports, and what you see before you in the form of the bill and the dash one amendments are the product of that. It's important to recognize, in our view, that there is a very important public benefit at work in the dredging of our channels, our harbors, and there's also, of course, a public benefit in the payment of royalties to the state. We think that this bill with the dash ones strikes a good balance between those two competing public purposes and public goods. We don't plow a tremendous amount of new ground in this bill, but we do get some very important clarifications as to what we need to do relative to payment of royalties. With that, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I've got Pete Williamson here, the executive director from the Port of St. Helens. He was involved on our behalf on the work group, and then, of course, you also have Steve Purchase with the Division of State Lands, and I have a representative of the Port of Portland in the back if there are any other technical questions. So with that, unless you have any questions for me, I'll turn it over to Mr. Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Questions for... Let's hold the questions at any rate until we finish the panel, if that's all right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing this bill to be heard. I'm Peter Williamson, the Executive Director of the Port of St. Helens. I am here to speak in support of House Bill 2688 with the amendments that have been proposed. As Ken said, this is a result of many discussions with the administrative staff of the Division of State Lands about the implementation of sand royalty rules as they were currently written. And we've had many meetings to attempt to clarify those rules and the implementation. And so we came to a joint understanding to propose legislation, to propose this bill to clarify the understanding between the ports and the Division of State Lands. It allows the use of material for public benefit while supporting local economic activities. It supports the maintenance activities of our waterways, and it removes a source of potential problems between local government and the Division of State Lands. I think it's a good bill. As Ken said, it doesn't really plow new ground. It really clarifies some language that did have some conflicting language, and as we discussed that with the administrative staff, we felt and we agreed that it was better to get this clarification through this mechanism. So rather than bore you with any more discussion, I'm just here to support it and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williamson. Purchase,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Division of State Lands. I'm just simply going to echo what Pete and Ken have said. We've worked on this issue and it has been around since 1991. It's probably about time we solve it. We have worked very hard with the ports group to try to clarify this language that we believe really meets what the intent of both revenue to the common school fund as well as trying to define those public purposes. So with this bill, we believe that it will give us clear statutory language, which will then allow us to go back through our administrative rules and clearly establish when royalties are not due and when royalties are due. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. The questions? Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to figure out, and maybe I'm just not understanding how the amendments change the original, because when I originally read the bill, I was very concerned about the potential fiscal impact on the Common School Fund. And our committee administrator tells us that there is now no revenue impact. At least that's what the revenue analysis says. So I guess I'm just trying to understand how we get to zero sum on this when you're saying, you know, the ports, and I understand what the intent is, and this is publicly owned facilities, so we don't want to be double, you know, sort of taxing ourselves. But I'm trying to figure out where is the loss of income going to be made up so there won't be an impact on the Common School Fund. So maybe I'm just misunderstanding how the amendments change the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Dingfelder, the fiscal impact, I believe, is indeterminate because we don't know how much of this material could be or would be used for a public purpose. But in the statute as it's currently written, there is two statutory portions of that statute that say that you can remove material within a half mile of the river for purpose. It doesn't define what that is. There's also a statute in the current statute that says any government political subdivision can remove material for purposes within 2 miles of the river. So it's already implied that you will get to remove some material from the river for some purpose. We try to define that better in administrative rule. And a lot of the conflicts that occur is when is that material that's being used under the current statute actually used as a royalty required material or a non-royalty required material. In addition to that, there are three other statutory exemptions in the statute already for channel deepening, flood control, and harbor maintenance. So rather than try to understand how you use the material, whether or not the material ever gets used as an article of commerce, and some of the activities that do occur from channel maintenance or channel dredging material is royalty free unless it's used as an article of commerce, we really work to try to put this language together that would clearly give the division some direction that we could further articulate in administrative rule when those royalties would be due. So I know it's kind of a confusing answer, but not every cubic yard of material that comes out of a river is a royalty required.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I might add to that. I think what Steve said is correct. Probably the ambiguity that remains is how we are defining public purposes.
Right.
And that is going to be a process. I think that the bill puts some fences around, provides some direction to the division as to what sorts of things will be public purposes and what things will not. But we are going to have to go through a process with the division that will be subject to land board approval to clarify specifically what those public purposes are. And our sense and the message we've certainly got very clearly from the land board over the years is they do not support giveaways of the common school fund. So we're gonna have to continue to work collaboratively with the division and with the land board to come up with something that that makes sense for the division as well as for the ports. But I think that's there's some give and take here, and I don't think we're looking at anything that's going to directly take money away from the common school fund. It's a question of what happens down the road as we define some of the terms, and that's going to be subject to land board review and approval. So,
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
Yeah, that's my basic concern, is obviously this committee not passing out anything that's going to have any negative impact on the common school fund, and I guess we'll just have to trust that the land board obviously would make that determination. So it's hard without having a fiscal determination for me to make this decision, but we'll just have to trust that the land board will be sort of overseeing that, and I'm sure they're concerned as well, as you mentioned, about any fiscal impacts on the common school fund given our current fiscal situation especially.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, at the risk of talking maybe more than I should, I think that I want to come back to this point that there are really two competing, not necessarily competing, but there are two parallel public purposes at work here. One is the public benefit and need to have the channels and harbors dredged, and making sure we've got a situation where we're not putting a disincentive to accomplish that goal, because clearly that's got a major economic impact on the state. And then you've got an equally important public purpose with the state-owned material. And so I think that the direction that this bill provides strikes a pretty good balance. It needs a little bit further clarification, and that's something that we're going to do working with the land board. So I appreciate your concern, and we've been concerned about that. The division has been concerned about it. And obviously it's your decision to make, but we feel fairly comfortable that it's in a direction with proper sideboards around it, that it's going to come together to the right balance.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is a technical question. I support the deepening of the channel. If you have all this material piled up somewhere and there's no immediate public need for it, is it worthwhile screening that and then making it an article of commerce and selling it? Can you make any money doing that, or is it just dredge material just piles up?
We have an expert.
I don't know about that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Schaffer, you bet. We currently have a number of sand and gravel licensees on the Columbia River that sell this material. We allow the material to be deposited on not only our state-owned lands or our state-owned islands in the Columbia River, but also on private property. If that material from channel deepening or channel maintenance is deposited on site and not used as an article of commerce, maybe it's not sold for several years, we charge no royalty for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's only royalty charge when the material is actually used as an article of commerce. Article of Commerce in the statute is not defined, but it is defined in administrative rule, and that's where some of our long discussions have been going on since the 1990s. If you use the material for fill, you barter it, you sell it, you exchange it, you do anything with it, you build on it, it becomes an Article of Commerce, and royalties due at that point.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up? And then when so is there a potential for actually making money for the common school fund then with this material?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffner, yes, there is. We currently make about $300,000 a year just off the Columbia River alone for our current lessees who do the maintenance dredging for the Corps, sell the material. We have two upland sites that we currently sell sand from. We're in discussions with a couple of operators and San Francisco Airport talking about potential uses of our state material for fill in the San Francisco Airport expansion. There's lots of opportunities, and we explore every one of those when they come up.
Okay, thank you. Question? Another comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Chalfler, if I might add to that, the Port of St. Helens was a licensee to stand on behalf of the Division of State Lands for many years down at Rainier, and we have another site that we're trying to turn into what we call a recyclable site. And by selling this material from those sites and paying a royalty to the state, the state benefits through the royalty. The local economy benefits because the material is made available for building purposes in the economy. Mm-hmm. And the channel is benefited because we don't have to go out and permit a new site. We don't have to find another greenfield site and go through all the permitting and mitigation and those types of activities. So that is, again, another one of the reasons we wanted to clarify these rules to allow those activities to be ongoing with more clear rules and regulations, and to actually encourage that type of activity.
Thank you. Any further questions?
If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2688 and open a work session on 2688.
Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move dash one amendment to House Bill 2688.
Representative Cruz moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2688. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2688 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2688. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, is there discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tolman.
I think we all got this letter from the governor's office. It didn't specifically mention this bill. It mentioned other bills that apparently have some concern about the Common School Fund. And I share that concern with Representative Dienfelder. Will this go on to Ways and Means?
No.
So it will just go on the floor?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. When a bill passes with amendments, we have to pass them again by Ways and Means for another check. So if there's a problem, they would catch it there and request that the bill be to the Speaker, the bill be moved to Ways and Means because there is an effect with this amendment. Right now, since they had not indicated there was an effect, it's not a thing, but there is another opportunity for Ways and Means to take a look at this.
If I may.
Wait, or at least fiscal, take a look at it.
So if there is a problem with the Common School Fund, that would be picked up somewhere along the line?
You would hope fiscal would pick it up on their second round, yes.
There's also, of course, a possibility Representative Common School Fund might make more money on it.
Oh, really?
Well, it's indeterminate.
I have a quick question regarding that,
sure.
Mr. Chair. And I don't know if our committee chair, committee staff knows this. If something's indeterminate, if it's, as we heard from the witnesses here, I mean, is that reported by, in the revenue impact? I mean, it's hard at this point because until they define, I mean, that's, I think what I heard was, and I see Steve nodding his head, until you define what the public purposes are, we don't really know how to determine it. And what I'm hearing is that the land board will help make that determination to minimize the impact on the Common School Fund. So, like I said, we're taking a leap of faith here. We're passing this out without...
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkhoffer, when it's indeterminate, then it's really up to fiscal revenue to determine if there is some reason to look at it. But if you'd like, we could call somebody from fiscal to come up and explain that to you. And then clarify if I'm wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Test isn't wrong on this, and he's absolutely correct that if the amendment raises concerns with legislative fiscal, they will tag it. That's standard practice, and then it would probably be sent back to committee to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Personally, I don't think that will happen in this case. So,
the other thing I'd like to add is a comment to this. Would you check on the letter that you have there and assume that's from the governor's office?
Correct. Mm-hmm. It's from the land board. It's from members of the land board.
And who is the land board?
governor, secretary of state, and the treasurer.
Yes. So it seems to me you have some reasonable control at this point, since the governor has firsthand say about what goes on in that agency.
You've lost me, Mr. Chair.
The governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer are the state land board.
And therefore?
And therefore, they are the ones overseeing.
So they, you're saying that they would make sure that there was no negative effect on the common school fund?
I think that they would have significant influence, or ability to have significant influence in this, in how we're using it.
Okay. Mr. Chair. On page 2 of that letter from the governor, Bill Bradbury and Randall Edwards, it does indicate that they are hoping to work with the interest to protect the interest of the Common School Fund. So I think that even though they're expressing concerns, that's a check, but they express their desire to move forward and protect, therefore, the interests that we're talking about here.
And the governor's office, the secretary of state's office, the treasurer's office certainly have all been able to be appraised that this bill is before us. And if they have concerns on this, since they are the land board, it is first the assumption of the chair that they would have made some recommendation to us, or appeared before us to testify, or will at a minimum, if they arrive at some problem or foresee some problem, will be there to intercede when it gets to the Senate.
Okay.
I mean,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comment? Call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Gingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
I was debating.
Okay.
And in light of both Representative Tomei's and Representative Dingfelder's, and perhaps some others who have spoken up on their concern about the state line or about the Common School Fund, I'm not going to ask for a motion to put this on the consent calendar and see if I have a volunteer for a carrier. Representative Shoffler has volunteered to carry this bill. It will be up to him to defend it in his caucus. Having received the majority, House Bill 2688 is passed and will be referred on to the floor. And Representative Shoffler will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2688. And at this point, I see we have a representative in the back of the room on, I believe it's House Bill 2659.
I'll let him sit there for a while.
Relax.
Thank you for your patience in staying here with us, Representative Merkley. We appreciate that. Our apologies for detaining you on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Mr. Tess.
House Bill 2659 requires State Marine Board to develop educational program on environmental consequences of operating two-stroke carbureted boat engines, requires Board to develop program to encourage replacement of two-stroke carbureted boat engines, directs Board to create rebate program for retiring two-stroke carbureted boat engines from service, requires Board to develop clean water refund program to reward persons for owning boat engines that meet federal environmental protection standards for engines to be sold in 2006 and later, creates marine engine rebate and education fund increases fees for certificate of number or registration in two steps and provides a portion of fees to go to the fund. This has prior reference to Ways and Means.
Representative, dash one. We have amendments on these.
Actually, a dash one and a dash two, as I remember. And it should have them handy. Did you have a dash two on these two?
Not needed.
Yep.
I only see the everyone's in consensus on the dash one.
The dash one. So
not everyone.
Well, not everyone. thank you.
The explanation, a brief on the dash ones, and if you have it, or did you just get those, Mr.
I just got them.
We just got those, and so as I look at this, it looks to me like the dash one is a gut and stuff, proverbial. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, yes.
So forgetting the explanation that has taken place preceding this, would you give us an explanation on the dash one amendments, please?
I'd be delighted to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm representing Jeff Merkley from East Portland. The dash one that you have before you represents half of the original bill. The original bill addressed the issues of education and the issue of setting up a rebate program, both related to two-stroke engines. Two-stroke carbureted engines, as you've heard previous testimony to, put approximately 25% of their fuel directly into the water. And we, fortunately, the good news is we have new, advanced, cleaner technology engines. And the goal has been to encourage the introduction of these new engines as that quickly as possible in order to reduce the oil that's going into the waters of the state. The stakeholders have been meeting to try to figure out what can be done within this session, what is appropriate to do, what has the support of the Marine Board and other groups, and have decided that the education portion is the portion that makes the most sense. And so the dash one preserves the education portion of the bill and gives a few additional details. And I really don't need to say a whole lot about it. It's probably most appropriate for me to simply say that the other folks are here ready to testify to the dash one.
Thank you, Representative Merkley. And before we call on the other folks, Representative Dingfelder would like to make some comments on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to commend Representative Merkley and the Marine Board for their the amount of cooperation that went on in drafting these amendments. We had numerous meetings, unending discussions, and I was very pleased, since I was helping in the facilitation of this as well, that we were able to come up with this amendment that all the parties agreed on, and I just wanted to thank both of them for putting a lot of time and effort into this and making sure that we were able to move forward with something that everyone could agree with. So I just wanted to commend both of them, and I know that Mr. John Hefner will be coming up here, but and I also appreciate the chair's willingness to help us work through this issue.
I don't have Mr. Hefner on the list.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative, and again, my apologies for detaining you from your other assignments. Yes, Mr. Don Hefner, would you hold? And I apologize for being out of a little order on this, but it seems to me the sponsor and the department are the first two that ought to be speaking to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. I'll try to prep it or limit my remarks to the dash one amendment. The Marine Board certainly supports the goal of improving air quality.
Go ahead. I'm
of improving air quality by reducing emissions from carbureted two-stroke engines, something we support. It's something the boating industry supports. It's something that the federal government has already mandated. The fact is, the cleaner marine engines are already here and will continue to replace older engines into the future, and that transition is already well underway. In the way of background, in 1996, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency enacted Clean Air Act regulations that require a 75% reduction in emissions from two-stroke engines by the year 2006. Most boat engine manufacturers are well on their way to compliance with the 2006 standards. In fact, many already meet or exceed the 2006 standards. The boating public is already purchasing engines with newer and cleaner technology, which includes four-stroke technology, direct injection technology, and other technologies that make these engines cleaner. In fact, advances in technology have actually created EPA-compliant two-stroke engines that are cleaner and more efficient than four-strokes. In other words, the problem is being addressed through federal regulation, manufacturer compliance, and voluntary conversion. As older two-stroke engines wear out, they are being replaced with cleaner engines. EPA estimates that by 2005, there will already be a 26% reduction in hydrocarbon emissions. That will increase to a 68% reduction by the year 2015. And as the law of diminishing returns kicks in, the further you get into this, EPA estimates a 73% reduction by 2020 and the full 75% reduction by 2025. So you get the biggest gains in the first years of turnover, and then the further along you get in the retirement program, the less return you get for each engine that goes out. We do know that about 80% of all outboards have a lifespan of 20 years or less. So the EPA rules and industry efforts to meet the 2006 standards will effectively solve this problem in the next 15 years or so. We've already taken positive steps to encourage the conversion from carbureted two-stroke engines to new technology. Information on new engine technology is available on our agency website. In publications, it was featured in our recent newsletter that went to all registered boat owners. The boating industry, engine manufacturers, and marine dealers are also promoting and marketing new engines. It's in their interest, certainly, and we've entered into a memorandum of understanding with the DEQ, the Portland Marine Dealers Association, National Marine Manufacturers, and the National Marine Retailers to work together to promote new engine technology. As you've heard in recent weeks, we've worked with the sponsor of the bill to scale it back into something that doesn't create a huge fiscal impact and a drain on agency resources. We already have plans to implement an education and marketing program aimed at sustainable boating as part of our 2003-2005 budget. A part of that will be aimed at promoting clean engine technology and best management practices. The proposed Dash 1 amendments do limit the scope of the bill while supporting our ongoing efforts to promote this technology, and I think the amendments in our proposed budget go hand in hand. So we can support the Dash 1 amendments that direct us to continue our cooperative work with DEQ, the dealers, and the industry to promote this technology, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Any questions from the committee? Seems like we've lost everyone else here.
Madam Chair, I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Don Hefner. I have a question that was posed to me, and I didn't have an answer. Does this bill and what it's attempting to accomplish, which are obviously very important, does this in any way impact those things we commonly known as jet skis?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, personal watercraft or jet skis are included within the EPA regulations. Many of them use two-stroke technology, and the personal watercraft industry has been very aggressive in converting their engines to new technology, and many of the devices that are sold today are compliant with the 2006 standard. They've been very proactive in moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Paul. Next, I'm actually going to ask Shane Jackson to come up, please. Shane, please state your name for the record.
I'm Shane Jackson from Portland, Oregon. I'm the legislative director for SCOW, Skippers for Clean Oregon Waters. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you about House Bill 2659. This bill represents over 6 years of compromise and work. This bill also is the product of a series of constructive conversations between the boating community, the marine industry, this committee, SCOW, the governor's office, members of the House, and other interested groups. The original draft is, in our opinion, an excellent piece of work that is almost exactly what was passed out of this committee with recommendation to pass last session. It is excellent not only for what it does, which would cheaply keep a million gallons of fuel out of our water, but it was also excellent because it was funded from the right place, it rewarded good behavior, and it sunsetted. Therefore, it is with a bit of sorrow that I must accept that House Bill 2659 cannot be passed in its current form due to the present pressing financial circumstances that require everyone to make sacrifices. I and my group accept that the bill as it currently is written is unworkable. We therefore submit that the amendment, the -1, before you be considered. If you pass HB 2659 with the -1 amendments, as I hope you do, it will still result in creating the most forward-thinking environmental boating policy by any state in this country. This is something that we can all still be very proud of. Therefore, I wholeheartedly endorse the -1 amendment and will work diligently to get House Bill 2659 passed into law. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Shane from the committee? And I see Representative Balto. Did you want to testify on this bill?
Representative Balto, can you take
just a moment? Sure. Any questions for Shane? Okay, well, why don't we have Trey Carcadon and Phil Donovan come up in the meantime. Thank you, gentlemen. And state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Trey Carcadon from Tualatin, Oregon. And I'd like to echo some of the comments made by Representative Dingfelder, as well as Shane Jackson and Director Don Hefner. We have worked long and hard on this, for the last 4 years anyway, that I've been involved with this issue. I actually got involved with it in the middle 90s. Thanks to this issue, my company was hired to do the national work on this on behalf of the industry. We are now recognized as national experts in this issue. So it's when I hear some of the representations made, I have to bite my bottom lip. But I also understand where we've come to, and I appreciate that very, very much. I think it shows a real consideration for our industry. I think it's headed in the right direction, and I can assure you on behalf of the state's marine industry and the national marine industry that we will work diligently to make meaningful progress, substantive progress, progress that hopefully we can measure next session and I'll be proud of. In 3 weeks, I go back to Washington, D.C. to discuss this issue with the EPA, with the National Marine Manufacturers Association, with the outboard motor manufacturers. And what I'm hoping is that this is the first step towards a model that we can replicate nationally and that we will replicate nationally. They're very interested in the work that we've provided, the information we've provided, and the steps that we make in this state. So on behalf of the state's marine industry, NSIA, that's the Northwest Sport Fishing Industries Association, the outboard manufacturers, the NMMA, National Marine Manufacturers Association, I want to thank you, and I also want to let you know that we do support this amendment.
Madam Chair, go ahead.
Representative.
Thank you. Trey, you mentioned your company, but you didn't say what the company was.
Company is Advanced Marketing Solutions Incorporated. My company represents Alumiweld Boats, the largest and oldest of the aluminum boat manufacturers in the country. Smoker Craft Boats, which is the third largest boat builder in the United States. Stevens Marine, which is the largest fishing boat dealer in the region. We also work with NSIA, the National Marine Manufacturers Association is one of our accounts. We represent several dealers, other dealers, small, medium, large dealers around the region, and are deeply involved in these issues regionally. I serve on several boards directed at this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, we're going to interrupt the panel that's here and ask Representative Dalto if he would like to. Representative Dalto, as you all will recognize, is a chief sponsor on the bill. Since we have done major rewrite to what he started out with, we're curious as where the representative is at with it. And I've asked him to come down or ask for his opinion, and appreciate your being here, Representative. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Billy Dalto, State Representative, Oregon House District 21. I've taken a look at the Dash 1 amendments, and I think they're fine. I don't think they go far enough. I'm sad to see that we are toning down what our attempt was, but I think the Dash 1s are something that we can live with at this particular time, and so I encourage you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments and move House Bill 2659 on to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Dalto? Thank you, Representative, and sorry to inconvenience you on this. I appreciate your coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have comments, Mr. Donovan?
Briefly.
Please.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. As you know, we had significant problems with the original legislation as it related to a significant fiscal impact. But thanks to the hard work of Representative Merkley, Representative Dingfelder should not sell herself short on her participation in the process of bringing folks together in the State Marine Board. We've created something here that complements national efforts that are underway. And we always try to identify good partnerships and win-win solutions when we were working on legislation in this building. And I think with the Dash 1s, we've taken a step in the right direction. So just wanted to come forward, having previously opposed the legislation, to let you know that on behalf of the Northwest Steelheaders, we do support inclusion of the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Are there questions of Mr. Donovan? No questions from anybody?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that constitutes our folks who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2659. And Paul, did you have a comment before we leave the public hearing session?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention this while I was up here, but Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board, for the record. In line 20, if you're going to consider these amendments, I'd just like to point out to you that line 20 of the page one of the amendments, where it says sold in 2006 and later, these engines are being sold today. And that's referring to the EPA standard, which is referenced in the line above. It may not be significant, but you could move the semicolon to past engines, and it would fix what I think is the drafting error there, because we're not talking about engines after 2006. We want to do this now.
Okay, so you're talking about move the semicolon
behind engines.
Behind engines.
And then just strike out sold
in line 20?
Yeah.
And delete?
Sold in 2006 and later.
Sold in 2006.
If you can do that today, it would clean it up. And we wouldn't have to pursue it in a further committee down the road. I don't know if you can do that, but if you have the latitude to, it would improve it.
I'm going to ask the sponsors if they're still here.
No.
All I have is
I discussed this with Representative Merkley.
Yeah, to work on this minor amendment when the bill gets to wherever it's going after it gets through.
We can do that, too. I didn't know if your committee has the latitude.
If we're just moving a semicolon, we could do that. we stretch my... I probably could do it, but in the process of doing it, it might...
I don't want to
make
create,
the...
I don't want to create waves.
No, I understand.
No pun intended, I'm sure.
Do you all understand the substantive amendment? What Mr. Heffner is referring to? On line 20, put a semicolon and delete sold in 2006 and later.
Because it's already being done.
Yeah, I would entertain a motion to amend the amendments.
Work session.
No, we're not.
We need to go to work session.
Before I ask for a motion, I think I probably ought to close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2659.
Mr. Chair, I will move the conceptual amendments to the dash amendments for House Bill 2659.
Representative Dingfelder has moved the conceptual amendments to the dash one amendments for House Bill 2659. The conceptual amendment is on line 20 to move the semicolon to behind engines and delete sold in 2006 and later. Are we clear on that?
Yes.
All right. Is there objection? Are there comments or objections to the conceptual amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Tomei. Or Representative Dingfelder.
Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2659.
No.
Amendment.
The amendment first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I move the amendment to House Bill 2659 be adopted by the committee.
Representative Dingfelder moves the dash one amendment as conceptually amended. He wants to vote no. Representative Dingfelder moves the dash one amendment as conceptually amended to House Bill 2659. Is there objection? Is there discussion and before objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I move House Bill 2659 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Stand by.
We're going to get the physical check and get the ways and means.
Excuse me. At this point, Representative, would it be too much of an imposition if I ask you to withdraw your motion to move it to the floor?
I'll explain why.
I understand stuff with fiscal. Yes, I will withdraw my motion to move House Bill 2659 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder removes her motion to refer 2659 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And let me ask Mr. Test to please explain why we're doing this.
This bill has a reference to ways and means, and the sponsors would like to see if they can avoid and go directly to the floor. The only way we can do that is to make a case for the speaker to make that decision. In doing that, that means we could pass this bill by as amended by fiscal, which we do immediately after this with the amendment. And if fiscal said there is none, then we have the case we need to go to the speaker to ask to do it and actually make the motion to send it directly to the floor with the speaker's permission to do so. We probably should consider bringing back the previous bill that we voted and do the same thing with that, which would eliminate any kind of a problem.
Mr. Chair?
Let's wait on the previous
bill. Okay, excuse me.
Yes. Mr. Chair, can I just make a comment on that? Because I'd like to say to the committee that there was some concern originally in the First Amendment about fiscal impacts. That language has been taken out of this revised amendment, and so I would respectfully request that we request that the referral to Ways and Means also be removed. And if you want to, I'm assuming that I see, you know, head nodding from the agency, and I don't know if you want to have them come up. And
I believe that the only person who can really remove this from Ways and Means is the Speaker of the House.
Well, Ms. Chair, you can vote in committee to rescind referral by prior reference. However, if the Speaker doesn't agree with that, she can stop it. So, I mean, the Speaker doesn't not necessarily have to take affirmative action. The committee can do it, but it's always wise to let leadership know ahead of time that you're going to do that.
And, Mr. Speaker, we have that information from the fiscal. It makes it a lot easier for the Speaker to do so.
Do you want a motion, Mr. Chair?
Pass it next week. I am going to temporarily... I'm going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 2659 as amended. Ask to have or get directly from the chief clerk the protocol that she would like to have this or needs to have this go through. And my apologies to the committee for this, but we are at the stage in the session when to make an error may not be recoverable. So you will indulge me, and we'll close this work session for right now, and we'll go back and we will open a public hearing. I think it's on 3297, isn't it? The next one on our agenda, Mr. Tess?
Yes, it is.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 3297, and the chair will be gone for a minute here, and Representative Dinkfelder will hold on to this camera.
Mr. Tess, could you please give us a summary of House Bill 3297?
House Bill 3297 forbids state land board from requiring owners of existing structures on waterways subject to navigability determination of the board to obtain permit, lease, or easement to maintain structures.
Okay, I'm actually going to ask the Division of State Lands, Mr. John Lilly, to come up here first, please. Morning, John.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. I'm here to speak to you today concerning House Bill 3297. A copy of our testimony is being distributed to you now. The bill, as we understand it, simply stated, would say that in the event that the land board would make a navigability declaration in compliance with the process currently laid out in state law, that any of the structures and uses that are in existence on the what would be publicly owned bed and banks of that waterway, any of the personal property and uses would be allowed to continue without requiring or without being without the requirement that there be authorization from the division and the land board for under lease, license, or easement as applicable under current state law. The way we see this is the public policy question that the is presented by this bill is, should persons who have developments within publicly owned waterways declared navigable by the board be allowed to continue their use without compensating the public for the use of the public land? And I need to note that that's kind of a high-level a statement of the policy question, but it needs to be maybe a finer point put on it, and that is that there are currently in existence in state law and administrative rule some exemptions for certain types of uses and structures on publicly owned waterways, such as wharf use and some easements. For example, recently the board allowed under rule that certain water rights, water use structures could be permitted without easement if they were in place prior to June, authorized under a water right prior to June 30 of this year. For a number of reasons, the division opposes the bill as currently presented to you. The bill would have an effect, although in difficult to determine, on future revenues to the Common School Fund, as it allows persons owning personal property on certain navigable waters not to have to compensate the public for the use of the public land. The waterways affected by this act would be those declared navigable in the future by the land board. We think that this bill is meant to be prospective, but maybe that needs to be clarified. The bill would create something of an inequity among waterfront users, waterfront owners, because existing structures wouldn't pay for their boat docks, their marinas, their sand and gravel operations, what have you, while fiber optic cables, what have you. But others who might come later, after the date of that declaration, would have to pay. Let me give you a little background about this whole matter of navigability. The Oregon Admission Act and the federal case law rule that navigable waterways are publicly owned. The federal courts have set down the standard that is used to determine ownership, but unfortunately at the time of statehood in 1859, Congress didn't give us a neat little list of what waterways are to be declared and be considered navigable. Subsequently, title, when it's passed from the federal government to private property owners at the time of statehood and after, the federal government was required to keep in trust, in reserve, the ownership of the beds of banks. And subsequently, title insurers, we find, usually advise waterfront property owners that their titles are not insured within the beds and banks of waterways, even though a deed may read to the center line. And courts have long held that despite what a deed may say, the beds and banks of navigable waters are publicly owned. Now, up until 1995, the state and the land board used a variety of methods in which to make navigability declarations. This body made navigability declarations. The land board did by administrative rule and by just simply acting as owner. To give you a sense of what kinds of waterways are typically determined to be navigable, I would say that they are the tidally influenced waters, the territorial sea are areas that are managed by the land board. Many of the large lakes, the Columbia Snake and Willamette Rivers are all examples of navigable state-owned, publicly owned waterways. So are portions of the Umpqua, Rogue, Klamath, Chetco, Mackenzie, John Day, and Sandy Rivers. In 1995, the legislature established a process under which the land board would follow to make navigability claims. And the process is called a navigability study, and it's an open public process that involves all interests and especially waterfront property owners. So far, only the Sandy has been declared navigable via this process, although studies have been requested from a number of other rivers, or for another number of other rivers like the North Sandy Am and the Upper Rogue. Currently, many private and some public developments on publicly owned waterways are authorized by the land board to occupy beds and banks of Oregon's publicly owned waterways through such means as leases, licenses, registrations, and easements. And the monies raised from these authorizations are deposited in the Common School Fund and used not only in the fund itself to build the corpus, but also for the operations of some of the agency programs. About $2 million are collected annually from sand and gravel royalties, marina leases, fiber optic cable easements, and the like. In conclusion, we'd say that the bill as currently drafted has some issues in regards to the inequities that it might create amongst waterfront property owners. It would allow a continuation of private development on publicly owned land without compensation, and it would likely reduce future revenue to the common school fund by some indeterminate amount, depending on how many waterways were to be studied in the future and found to be navigable. Thank you. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions from committee members? For Mr. Lilly? Thank you.
Okay. Scott? Ashcroft?
Oregon Agricultural Alliance.
Thank you, Mr.
Good morning,
Chair.
Scott.
Members of the committee, I'm Scott Ashcom, today representing the Oregon Agricultural Alliance and the Yamhill County Improvement District. We support House Bill 3297. This is a bill which is needed. The need for this bill has been created by the State Land Board, which in the past 6 to 9 months has voted to conduct an administrative navigability determination on the John Day River, extensive stretch of the John Day River. And I believe that the chairman of the land board, Governor Kulongowski, is also directed the department to prepare the required notices to potentially affected landowners on the Trask portions of the north and south Sandia and the Kilchis, and I believe there's another river which is included in that batch of five. What you will be seeing here, based on my experience about 16, 18 years ago, the last time a large number of rivers went through the navigability study process of the Division of State Lands, you're going to see massive public hearings conducted in the river basins where the navigability determinations and the studies are taking place. Some of these meetings, the last time we went through this large-scale navigability determination process, have hundreds of citizens attend these meetings. There are public hearings where the Division of State Lands talks about what the program involves and what possible consequences that a navigability determination may have for landowners who believe that they have title to the beds and banks of these waterways, and who believe that they have been paying property taxes on the property that is described in these deeds. These deeds, just to, a navigability determination is essentially a matter of determining a historical fact. And that fact is whether on Valentine's Day of 1859, which is more than 140 years ago, that particular stretch of river was susceptible in its ordinary condition of being used as a highway of commerce on Valentine's Day of 1859. And that's a historical question to establish in a court proceeding whether that stream was, to quote the law, navigable in fact. As a matter of fact, the Division of State Lands has, since 1995, the ability to conduct an administrative determination of navigability to establish that fact. But as you see on the printed version of the bill, lines 12 through 14, nothing in the administrative determination authority of the land board is intended to any way stand in the way of a court determination of navigability, in fact, on Valentine's Day of 1859. Since 1859, the federal government, acting under the Preemption Distribution Act of 1841, authorized the General Land Office of the federal government, now it's known as the Bureau of Land Management, but in those days was called the General Land Office. They authorized the General Land Office to issue title to lands in Oregon under numerous federal land grant acts.
including the Timber and Stone Culture Act, including the Donation Land Claims Act, and numerous other acts which authorized the federal government to issue title through the General Land Office to public lands prior to the federal government acquiring title to those lands itself. The Preemption Distribution Act of 1841. That was called preemption. It was title preemption. The federal government had not acquired title to lands from the owners of those lands in the territory of Oregon at the time. But they issued, they authorized the General Land Office to issue title to these lands prior to the federal government acquiring title to the lands itself, for obvious reasons. The Native American tribes, which were in possession of that land, had not yet been subdued and title transferred to the federal government. So, after years, after not quite 100 years, following 1859, you had the General Land Office issuing titles to hundreds of thousands of acres of lands in Oregon to landowners. And that's how they acquired these titles. The public possession is the only issue that I'm addressing here. Because the landowners on the beds and banks of these rivers, which have not yet been determined as a matter of fact in a court of competent jurisdiction or by an administrative determination, to have been navigable by the federal standard. These people believe that they own titles to the land, and they will challenge an assertion of title by the land board in a court. They'll do it. So if they built irrigation points of diversions, if they've built the kinds of structures that are described in this bill, there will be a legitimate issue in many, many cases which may well find their way into the courts as to whether or not the Division of State Lands has the authority to require an easement across the property for these purposes. So this bill is needed. I disagree with Mr. Lilly that there'll be a fiscal impact of the bill. I think there probably would be, the fiscal impact of passage of this measure would probably be to reduce the cost in the long run to the state of Oregon and the Division of State Lands that it will incur with the litigation that is sure to follow from these navigable streams determinations. So we support the bill. We support it as printed, without amendment, and urge you to vote yes on this and send it to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ashton. My questions?
I have one. I know you're shocked.
What?
I said I know you're shocked. I have a question.
Why would I be shocked?
I'm always asking questions. I'm so inquisitive. Scott, a couple of things. I mean, I do have a differing opinion about the potential impact on revenues to the Common School Fund, but I'm not going to, sit here and debate you on this. However, one of the concerns I have upon reading of this bill is about conflicts between private landowners. And the concern was, just an example, somebody who owns property in a bank and, say, a houseboat owner. I mean, my concern is that there we could be setting ourselves up also for potential conflicts, owner versus owner, on some of these structures. And I just was wondering if you had any comment on that.
Madam Chair, it seems to me that the bill would create, and I don't know if I'm really understanding the nature of your question, but it seems to me that if there's no conflicts between adjacent landowners now as a regard to this structure, that there would be no new conflicts between adjacent landowners brought about by passage of this measure.
Well, let me clarify my question. Right now, somebody wants to put a structure in, they have to get a permit, correct? And under this bill, they would not have to obtain a permit from the department. Is that correct?
That stands to reason from reading the bill as printed that the condition that you've laid out would be accurate, yes.
Okay, so I guess where I'm getting to my question is, say you own a house on, you know, the Sandy River. I own a house on the Sandy River. You want to put in a dock. You know, there could be conflict between structures as far as if there's, you know, no requirement for permit, you know, and you're going to block maybe access to my dock. I'm just concerned about if we say, you know, you don't need a permit, there's no requirement that you go to the agency. I don't know if this has come up in your discussions. I can see the potential for that.
Madam Chair, I do not see the potential for that. It seems to me that proposed land use, which requires a permit, would require a permit from the planning department of the county in which the land was located, and that potential conflicts between landowners over matters such as access or the nature of that structure in some way limiting access or limiting the ability of an adjacent landowner to own the property would be dealt with through the county land use planning process and the siting of that use, not through the Division of State Lands. I'm not certain that the Division of State Lands even has an administrative process for resolving that kind of conflict. It's usually done, in my experience, through the county courts and county commission.
The department to address?
Sure.
Okay. I wonder if I can just have the department up here to address it. And but my major concern with the bill is the potential impact on revenues, just for the record. And we heard from the previous bill that it was indeterminate, and I have the same concerns about any indeterminate impact on the Common School Fund. But I know, Mr. Lilly, if you can try to address my concern about the permitting issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, as I understood it, your scenario was property owner A has a dock, property owner B wants to put a dock in.
Just as far as potential conflicts, and could you see potential conflicts arising if there was no permit required, if it would be completely covered under county land use planning? I guess I'm just trying to make sure we're not creating potential conflicts between landowners or conflicting uses here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes, there is a conflict here, and in my testimony I pointed out that while this bill speaks to existing structures and uses, it's our understanding that those uses would be existing at the time that the land board makes the declaration, not at the time of statehood. If I came along later and wanted to put a dock in after the declaration, then my neighbor basically has the dock where he is, and I may not be able to take advantage of my riparian right to put my dock out there, and the agency would then have to not be able to give that new dock a registration.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, may I address that point?
Pardon me.
Mr. Chair, I'm...
Oh, pardon me. Mr. Chair.
I wondered if I'm...
Mr. Chair, I have never been confused on that issue.
Mr. Chair, I thought you might still have been on recess. I don't see how the Division of State Lands has the authority to require a permit or an easement for lands for which it has not yet asserted title. Mr. Lilly is talking about a situation which follows the assertion by the land board of its title to these lands. So I don't see how any conflicts between potential uses of adjacent landowners are in any way affected by the land board when it has not yet asserted title to such lands. We're talking about upon the assertion of title to property.
My assumption is that Brendan McCarthy in Legislative Council is monitoring this committee hearing, and I am therefore waiting for Mr. McCarthy to come down and explain this for us, so that I have rather than having this debated here, I'd like a third party opinion. I understood he's being contacted as we speak. So, Representative, I think Representative Schaffler was.
Thank you. As far as title goes, you know, land ownership, who owns what? Now, this land we're sitting on right now, you could make an argument it was stolen from people. The land your house is on, we could make that argument for. So I don't even want to get into all that. I think it's, quite frankly, it's a waste of time. Let's assume for a second that the state does own the waterways, and they can determine what's navigable or not. That may be a big assumption.
One that is necessarily met with enthusiasm.
Mine is a land use question. Are these structures considered boats? Are they considered houses, docks? If I build a dock out on the land underneath the water, do I have to get a building permit from the community it's in, as well as a permit from the state land board? Can you clarify all that for me, please? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, very good questions. The types of structures on publicly owned waterways are of all types. In fact, if you've had the pleasure of eating lunch at Moe's in Florence, you have an idea of the range of structures that are built upon state-owned submerged and submersible lands. They range from log rafts to small docks to party houses moored on the waterfront near Wilsonville. Restaurants, fish canning canneries, you name it, they're every imaginable type of use. When one wants to construct such a facility, of course, they're going to be regulated by the local land use requirement and whatever building code applies. But in order to occupy the publicly owned waterway, the state law and the land board's requirements are that there be some authorization issued by the public in order to authorize that use to occupy a publicly owned waterway space. And there is reasonable compensation paid for the privilege of doing so, because you are, of course, occupying a part of public domain when one is on that in the waterway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now, Mr. Chair?
I'm looking to Scott. I mean, you're not necessarily in agreement.
Mr. Chairman, all I can do is just reiterate what I've said before. Until the land board has asserted title administratively through a navigability determination and in federal court, it seems to me, it's not a public waterway.
May I please, sir?
Please.
I hope the title of my house is secure. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then we have to determine whether a tribe that would own it is a tribe or not. So I really, this is, in my opinion, with all due respect, Mr. Ashcombe, this is an exercise in futility. But my question still wasn't answered. You answered part of it. If I build a structure out there and I build a restaurant on top of it, do I have to go through all the land use permitting just like I would any other building too?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions, if I may, of both witnesses.
Thank you.
All right. First off, in deference to my good friend, Representative Schaffler, I would strongly disagree with you that this is a private property rights takings issue, in my opinion. And I think that's really the basis of the issue, frankly. Private property ownership is the basis of our Constitution, as much as free speech is. And as far as I'm concerned, it is the preeminent issue here. Now, we just had a series of hearings around the state regarding what happens when you declare a river navigable. And at least the one hearing that I attended in the district that I am honored to serve in, Sweet Home, which Mr. Lilly was there, Gene Wilkinson was there, and other folks, it was pretty clear that the folks in attendance were landowners, very concerned about the government declaring a portion of their property and assuming title to it after, you know, they had owned it for many years. And I really believe that's the heart of the issue here and why this has come forward.
May I respond to that, please Mr. Chair?
Could we... we're not in work session.
Okay, right, sir.
Okay.
All right. And as a consequence, let's...
my apologies, Mr. Chair. We can share our...
Yes.
forward
to it. Do that in work session.
Mr. Lilly, currently... as defined in the law here, in the bill, I should say, in the bill, on lines 19 and 20, it talks about structures, could be dams, diversions, pumps, irrigation works, docks, and piers. Currently, your division, your department, does not require permits to for me to put a pump in... any waterway, an irrigation pump?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, currently, in order to, if you have an existing water right, under our current regulations, you do not need an easement for that purpose. You can, if you wanted to put a new pump in a new location under a new water right coming in effect after June 30, 2003, then you would need an easement for that purpose.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I may, John, does that then mean that if I have a pumping location and within my water district, we have a process where one year, if I'm not going to grow a crop there that I want to irrigate, but on another field I do want to grow a crop, and we have a process where I can transfer that pumping location, does that mean when I transfer that pumping location then I have to get a new permit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no, that does not mean that you'd need a new easement, because I believe as we've structured the easement requirements, it would go with your point of diversion, and as long as it didn't trigger a review of the water right application because your point of diversion was moved in excess of whatever that requirement is, it would not trigger a new easement.
Okay.
Excuse me, Representative, may I interject
yes.
here a little concern that I might have? The issue you're talking about was resolved by rule.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And rules are in flux, are they not? Well, potentially.
Mr. Chair, one would hope they are not, but my colleagues would disagree with me. They think we do quite a bit of rulemaking. But yes, sir, as we approach issues, we do change rules.
Part, I think your issue still is present, Representative, and I'm sorry again to get out of the public hearing into a semi-work session, but I didn't want to get past this point.
Okay.
You were, you know. And the only reason I'm semi-familiar with that is it seems to me we had a hearing and it varies in some other things on that in front of a committee that I had the good fortune to be on in a previous time. So please go ahead.
Currently, if I had one of the structures identified by the rule, am I paying money into the common school fund now to have a permit for that dock or that pump
Mr.
structure?
Chair, Representative Krupp, if you have a water right of a water diversion structure on a publicly owned waterway today, in all likelihood you're probably not authorized under an easement, and that's why we amended the rule and made it and did what the land board amended the rule here within the year to basically make it available for all people who have current water rights existent on currently owned, state-owned, current publicly owned waterways to not require them to have a water right. Okay, so if you've got a water right today on, let's say, the Lower Rogue River, but you haven't, for some reason, didn't get an easement or didn't know you needed an easement from DSL, the land board has accommodated that circumstance by allowing you to be there and authorizing that basically en masse by rule.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I didn't quite answer my question.
Okay.
In that, let's say I had a dock on the river right now, am I paying money every year or into the common school fund today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, yes, you will be.
Okay.
If you're on a state-owned, publicly owned waterway today, and you have a dock, it's eligible for registration. and many of them are. There are almost, there are in excess of 2,000 of such structures on the major developed portions of Oregon's waterways, and somewhere in the neighborhood of nearly 70-80% of those are authorized. The remainder are being pursued to be authorized.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, this bill as it is currently written would, if I already have a dock and if I'm paying money in the common school fund, this bill would make it so that I don't have to pay that money in anymore. Is that correct? Is that your interpretation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that's my interpretation, since when a new navigable a new navigable waterway would be declared, and the land board would be asserting title for the first time. If there was a dock present on that waterway, then this bill would say that dock did not need to be authorized as long as it stayed there and it could be maintained forever.
Okay. Yeah. Could you also hold that question for Brendan, who will be up here momentarily?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Cruz.
That confused me, because if I have a dock and it's already state lands and I'm already paying that fee, I'm not sure how this would say that I'm no longer paying a fee, simply because this deals with existing structures on lands if the state takes ownership. So there's not a loss to the common school fund in this. What there is some structures that currently exist when the state takes dominion won't be collected on. So it's not a loss, it's just less of a gain in the future. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, yes, and that's what our testimony speaks to.
Okay. So
Mr. Chair, if I may respond, that really is the crux of my question. It's, what if you're on a non-navigable waterway? Today, are you paying money into the common school fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no. Not for the purposes of a dock on a non-navigable or a river not yet be determined navigable.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So we guys will drag a few yards of concrete out of sand out of it to make it navigable, and then we'll get
Let's now start talking about dredging.
Start in the Willamette.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one comment?
Please, and then we want to bring Brendan up.
You know, not going really to the issue of permits that are required by Division of State Lands, but going to the issue of property taxes that are paid by the landowners on that land, and I might add, on the improvements, including docks, including irrigation works, that's. I believe that everything that you've just ascertained through your questioning of Mr. Lilly with regard to permits also applies to property taxes.
So then, Mr. Ashcom and Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding your point, is that the current owner of an existing structure on a non-navigable waterway is paying property taxes on that. If the state assumes the ownership, then there's no property taxes paid on that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krupp, I believe that the statute provides for compensation for this variety of regulatory taking, in my opinion, but the land board, I believe, has to authorize the compensation.
You wanted to make a quick comment on this?
Well, I'm not sure where to start, Mr. Chair. I heard some things that I hadn't heard before. What we have found in dissecting this property tax question, for example, let us use the Clackamas River and the Sandy River as examples in Clackamas and Multnomah counties. On the Sandy River, we found that the property tax assessor in Multnomah County had subdivided the tax lot into various classifications of land and assigned taxes based upon the values of those classifications. So let's say you had a parcel that was 15 acres, and 5 acres of those were in the bottom land below the line of ordinary high water, and the remaining, there were 2 acres that he could assign valued as a home site, and the remainder was maybe a pasture. So the values of each parts of those lands of that parcel would be, the value would be determined for taxation purposes based upon the highest and best use. In Multnomah County, what they did is they just quit taxing the land below the line of ordinary high water, even though it was, and they actually excluded it from the tax lot. In Clackamas County, the tax, the assessor on the Molalla, Clackamas, and Sandy Rivers did it a little differently. They assigned a single value, a minimal value, I've been told, anything from $10 to $50, and then assessed taxes upon that value. So the tax assessors in the state use a variety of methods in order to come up with the value for that portion of the land that, that lies below the line of ordinary high water, whether or not the waterway is, has been determined to be publicly owned.
John, does that include improvements like a dock or something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'm glad you asked that, because we also have done some testing and questioning on that matter as well, and we find that, for example, in Clatsop County, there are a great number of duck shacks and other types of facilities that are out on the Columbia River on the publicly owned waterway. And in our attempt to identify how many of those there were, et cetera, we went to the county tax assessor, because obviously if the improvement is worth much, then they would be shown on the tax rolls. To our surprise, they're not on the tax rolls. The county assessor in that county took the view that if the property didn't exceed a certain value, and often I've heard $10,000 being the threshold in one county and $3,000 in another, that if the personal property didn't exceed that amount of money, then they wouldn't add it to the tax rolls.
Okay. And we're going to move on here and ask Brendan, and I know we've got a couple others to testify on this, but would you come up and straighten us out on the legal aspects of this, Ms. McCarthy?
And
the chair would like to make special note to give recognition to Representative Flores for bringing us this very short and simple bill.
Anything I can do to help the cause.
No, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm not certain that I can provide complete clarity. I can give you my opinion, and I'm certain that the opinion will probably be contradicted by people in this room. But and I was not completely, with both ears at least, monitoring this committee before I was called down, so I'm not exactly sure of how we got to this point. But I will try to provide as much clarity.
I mean, I can't imagine anything more entertaining.
Yes. It has been my opinion, written opinion in the past, and the opinion of our office, that the study process established in 274-400-412, while does declare the nature and extent of what the state believes the state's interest in the waterway is, that the ultimate decision for that determination is a federal decision that must be accomplished in federal court. That said, I would believe that it would be a corollary to that opinion that the declaration by the State Land Board of the state's nature and interest does not obviously convey that property to the state as of 1857, which presents an interesting question as to what exactly the effect of 274-400-412 is. It certainly declares the state's nature and interest. But beyond that, we don't believe, my office and myself, does not believe that it conveys that property.
Mr. Chair, may I ask legal counsel a question?
Of course.
Okay, then, I wish Representative Krupp was still here. Let's assume the state doesn't own the waterway. In land use, in like my house, I own my lot, and it extends out to the middle of the right-of-way. I own that property. It's my property. Yet I am taxed to pay for the improvements, which I willingly
do because it improves my, it makes it safer, nicer, better. Let's assume then that the waterways are the same thing, that I own, that Representative Tomei owns her lot out to the middle of the Willamette. Let's just assume it's a right of way. That's a good comparison, I think, in my mind. But the state would still, or the governing body, the city, the county, the state, the federal government, would still be allowed to exercise its ability to charge for improvements, charge for permits for improvements for structural or even the use on franchise fees. The use are charged on for utilities are charged the franchise fee in order to use the right of way and the ground underneath of it. So either way you look at it, I think the federal government, the federal, state, county, or city government has an argument that is established with long history of charging any number of fees or any of that. Now, if you just don't want to pay a fee or a tax, I can appreciate that. I really can. I don't want to either, but it brings me benefits. That's my perspective. That investment, I get a benefit out of it. Now, let's assume then the state doesn't own it, just as you said. Still, though, we still, unless this were to pass, still have that right. I think it's just an attempt to get out of paying a permit, just to get out of paying it. And you all are using this argument that the state doesn't own the land. Well, the city doesn't own the land underneath the street that's out in front of my house. I own the bank owns it. We're purchasing that. So I guess I'm just trying to work this out in my head, Mr. Chair, more than anything. And I really don't have a question. I apologize.
Thank you. Well, fine. Time. Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, if I can attempt to address that non-question. I believe the way this bill is structured, what we're talking about in the new language is nothing in this section. That is the declaration of this, of the nature and extent of the state's claim by the state land board allows for the... permits the board to require those permits, leases, or easements. And that's only specifically directed at this declaration of the state's nature and extent of the interest. So while I think your statement is correct, there are certainly many things that, many fees and permits and other existing types of regulatory structures that go on in the state on every level. What we're addressing here is not whether the state may have the authority to establish a fee generally. It's whether this study and report and declaration in 274-400 to 412 establishes the ability of the state to require a permit, lease, or easement. So it is very limited in that way.
Thank you.
If I may...
Representative.
Ask. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Representative Schaffler, bringing up that question. And I'm sorry I was distracted. I didn't hear the whole answer. But I do own property on the Willamette River. But my assumption is what I'm hearing is I don't own out to the middle of the river as I do on the street in front of me. But indeed, the state owns not only the river, but the bank. Is that correct? Am I correct in assuming that?
I believe that you are correct. I don't know exactly where on the Willamette River you own it, but probably, yes, the Willamette is generally considered navigable, at least tidally influenced up to the falls at Oregon City. And obviously someone from DSL could tell me the extent of the navigability of the Willamette River, but I don't know what river mile, but I would assume that, yes, you do not own out halfway in the middle of the Willamette.
Right. And what is curious is that neighbors of mine that live north of me, where sort of a slough, they do own, I mean, they're charged tax on property in the middle of the slough. But that part is not navigable because in the summertime it creates a slough. The river flows through there in the wintertime. So I'm assuming even in their property that the state can claim up to the bank. Is that true, Brendan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it's difficult for me to express an opinion on a specific issue of land ownership. Generally speaking, the state does not own the beds and banks of a non-navigable waterway and does own the beds and banks of a navigable waterway. And that's where the difficulty arises. I noticed that there was a phrase used in earlier testimony that was publicly owned right-of-way, a publicly owned waterway. I'm not sure when that term is used as to what that's referring to exactly. So I think the crux of the issue here with this bill is, does the state have the ability to declare the nature and extent of its interest on its own by doing a study, finding that a river, in its opinion, is navigable, and then asserting that because, in its opinion, the river is navigable, it owns the property, or whether that's ultimately a federal question. And in my opinion, it is a federal question, and I think that's the thing I'm going to keep following, you know, reminding people of is that we can't, in my opinion, just determine that a river is navigable and then claim that property and start charging people or start requiring permits, leases, and easements over that property.
We meaning the state.
We meaning the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. And we're going to need to move on. Appreciate your coming down, and I'm just crushed that you weren't sitting there watching and monitoring. understand. And I'd like to have Katie Fass and Gene Wolf, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Wilkinson, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. There's been a lot of good discussion on this issue, so I won't duplicate that. It is true that the state has a right to make navigability determinations and in that assume ownership of the beds and banks up to the ordinary high watermark of these areas. Previously, those beds and banks are privately owned, and farmers especially have irrigation structures established on those areas of the banks at times that could be assumed by the state, and they were in the past privately owned. I heard fees mentioned, and fees are not so much my concern here. Of course, given the agriculture economy, we scrutinize additional fees pretty heavily. That's true. But what I'm more concerned with is when the state assumes ownership of this, of these waterways and this property, there has been huge investments made to the agriculture property, and it's completely dependent on those irrigation structures and the ability to get irrigation onto that farm property. Without irrigation, there is no agriculture. So I think I'm skeptical when the state assumes ownership of that property, for it to be in the discretion of the state whether to allow the continued use of that property for those irrigation structures and facilities. I think the state, that wouldn't be fair. I think the state agrees with that in that they have, as you heard from John Lilly, established administrative rules to allow those irrigation structures to exist on that state land and exempt us from the need for easements. In my view, this bill does the same thing. Of course, it gives us more security to have it established in statute that those irrigation structures would be able to continue to exist unfettered and have that certainty that a statute provides rather than administrative rule. But so it's not so much the fees, it's the ability to continue using that state property for those irrigation structures, which without those structures and those facilities, agriculture could no longer exist on the property. So that's why we support House Bill 3297. I just want to say this bill does go further in mentioning docks and piers than what we represent for our constituents. But it does relate to the diversions, pumps, and irrigation works, which is something that's very important to, obviously, to the farming community. So that's why we support House Bill 3297.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment?
I don't want to deny anybody's ability that they're already diverting water for irrigation purposes. I have no desire to come along and deny that. That's not definitely not what. And just for clarification, and maybe Representative Flores can clarify this to her bill or anybody here. Now, the structures that are existing, they would be just granted if this passed. Forgive me. If this passes and the state comes in and declares a water body navigable that before was not, therefore making it so you didn't need one of these permits, that would just create a conditional use permit for that structure. Am I correct? But now, will this also mean all structures and all new structures from here on out will not require a fee on navigable streams and bodies of water? That's what I'm not getting at here. Now, I do not want to create. You already have a diversion. You've had it for decades. I don't want you to have to pay a fee if the navigability is, if it's determined navigable, because I think that's unfair. It's just like if I have a structure on my property, the building code changes, the city comes along and says, well, we changed the code, now you got to pay this fee. I don't agree with that either. So is that, I don't really have this clarified in my head.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shuffler, well, the statute, I think, refers to existing structures. So it would be structures that currently exist. Mm-hmm. When the title changes hands from a private property owner to the state, then those structures could continue to exist unfettered and free from the need for permits, licenses, or easements.
But new ones, Mr. Chair, would be required.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Katie. Very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Katie Fass with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We are in support of House Bill 3297. It allows landowners who have made significant improvements and investments into property with structures of irrigation equipment is our main concern as well. It allows them to maintain the use of these structures and also maintain the ability in the structures to function. We are in support of this. As you've heard, there are already rules for engagement or for irrigation equipment. We would just like to see that codified in the statute. So we ask your support of 3297.
Thank you, Katie.
Seeing no further discussion, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3297 and open a work session on House Bill 3297.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3297 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as written.
Representative Krupp moves House Bill 3297 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there comments, statements?
Mr. Chair, I...
Representative Tomei.
I regret that I will not be able to vote in favor of this. I think we had enough questions that were raised regarding this bill that I'm afraid I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I also will be voting no, mainly because my concern that the questions regarding potential impact on the school common school fund has not been, I think, sufficiently addressed. So I have similar concerns, as I noted earlier in today's hearing, about our first bill or second bill, 2688. I am concerned about any impacts on the common school fund. So I'll be a no on this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
This doesn't have an impact on the Common School Fund, clearly. Potentially, it could have an impact on this Common School Fund, but that's pure speculation at this point in time. What this bill very clearly does is it has a protective impact on private property owners. And, I personally, Common School Fund may be important, but the citizens of Oregon are my prime concern in this, and the ability of private property owners to have some certainty to the protection of their property if the state determines a waterway to be navigable, I think is important. And I want to thank Representative Flores for bringing this bill forward.
Mr. Chair. I just want to thank good representative for pointing out that its potential impacts, and my main concern is the children of Oregon. So I will be voting no because of the possible potential impacts on the Common School Fund.
Does that mean I have to give you two no votes?
Sure.
Since that you've spoken to it twice.
That ups the number, sure.
Other questions? Other comments? Oh, Representative
Shockler was first.
I will be voting yes because I don't think we can come in and put a permit on some structure that's already exists because of code changes or title changes. I just don't agree with that. I'm sorry. If we're not getting money for that now, I don't see why, and we're not going to later, I don't see the impact on the school fund, which I'm very concerned about too. But I do want to say I do take issue with whether or not the state has the ability or the authority to own the submersed waterways. I don't agree with the logic. How far back in time do you go? Our Constitution, you're right, protects property owners, and that's a good thing. But if you say that you could project that logic back and say, under the very same logic that our Constitution protects our property rights, and say, well, you paid money for this land, it's yours. You paid for it, or you homesteaded it. Then why not jump? That's a slippery slope. Why not jump back before July 4th, 1776, and give those folks and those members of that the tribes or that society the exact same rights that I assume that they live under our Constitution as well? So that, you know, whether it be Valentine's Day or whether it be 4th of July or whether it be the birth of Christ. Any one of those, pick one. Where do you draw the stop line? That's not the issue here. Forgive me for going on, Mr. Chair, and I will be voting yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to say I'm clearly in favor of this legislation for a number of reasons, and I frankly think that Representative Shoffler hit the nail on the head. This is a grandfather issue. Grandfathered properties that existed before a certain rule went into effect is a policy that's very well employed in this state, and I think is appropriate and proper. This is also a takings issue in my view. I think there is a fair case that can be made in respect to the questions that were asked about property taxes currently being received on some structures in some counties, so what loss that may potentially be to the county. If we're going to talk about potential losses to the Common School Fund, then we could talk about the fact that we're not logging the state trust lands enough and the potential losses to the Common School Fund in that regard. We could talk about the fact that we don't have new fees, or we don't have fees on people who would like to go walk on those and watch birds or go hiking on those particular areas, and that is a loss to the Common School Fund. I mean, we can carry that logic forward to the extreme if we want. I think the reality here is that the courts have recognized, and so has most, I guess, individuals who believe strongly in the premise of private property rights, that if a government action is going to cause the loss of private property in this state, that it is a fair idea that individuals, first of all, be compensated for that, and that there shouldn't be a regressive cost to that owner of that taking. So I think this is a great bill. I think it is a fair idea, and I also want to thank Representative Flores for bringing the concept forward.
Mr. Chair, I should have announced earlier that I have a potential conflict of interest since I do own property on the Willamette River.
One thing, members of the committee, would save you a lot of problem as far as this bill is concerned if you would take the lead of the chair of the committee and make sure you buy a home on a hill.
Mr. Chair, I should also serve notice of potential conflict of interest. I now own property on the Pudding River. However, where my property is, it is a small trickle, and I doubt that it would ever be declared navigable. But who knows?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just want to say, great minds think alike. My house is on a hill, too.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Dingfelder.
No.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. House Bill 3297 is lacking a notice from the legislative fiscal. That it has any fiscal is going to be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the chair would like to recognize the good representative who brought us this simple half a page bill, and ask Representative Flores if she would like to carry the bill.
I'd be privileged, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that it's so rare that we have a short bill that actually passes without amendment.
With that, we have closed the work session on House Bill 3297. And we are going to move just slightly ahead of the agenda and do a work session on House Bill 2887. You have amendments on this, Mr. Test?
Yes, I do. The dash two amendments are the ones that are under considerations. And for some reason, I gave it some. I don't have it handy here. Let me find it.
There you go.
Okay. Basically, as per discussion at the last at the hearing, to bring this into to compliance to be exactly like the federal definition, there's been changes made to the original to the bill on page one. You can read it yourself there. So basically what these things do is bring this bill into exact verbiage as to what the federal bill definition is.
Okay. Everyone understand the amendment? Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2887.
Representative Cruz moves the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2887. Is there discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2887 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2887 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. House Bill 2887 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm looking for sure. Representative Cruz. Do you want to do a?
Do you want it? It's your bill, Mr. Chair. Do you want it on consent?
It's fine with me if it's on consent. I like to move things.
Okay. I move House Bill 2887 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2887 as amended be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so directed. We're excused, I think, for a while.
Yeah, there has been excuse.
It's at
10:45.
And we'll have an hour of
our courtesies,
and sometimes a courtesy. I'm going to open a public hearing on Bill 2800.
They just all walked out.
2800.
Yeah. Who's the sponsor of the bill, Mr. Chair? Sponsor of the bill is Representative Smith, Tootie Smith. I don't see her here.
Representative Smith has asked not to have to rely on us because she has pressing other involvements today. Do we have, or are we still running them down?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may be so bold.
Yes, sir.
The Oregon Garden, at least the southern half of the Oregon Garden, lies within the boundaries of my representative district. And I have to say I find this a pretty intriguing concept, actually, that we would dedicate some money from the OEB board for creating a center for research and development for plant material that could be used to address environmental problems and support sustainable environment. I kind of like that idea. I think there's an idea we ought to explore.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I need to declare a conflict of interest on this bill.
potential conflict of interest because I've done some consulting work for the, with the Oregon Garden Foundation.
Thank you, Representative. So noted. We have Rick Gustafson. I butchered that very badly. And Scott Ashcombe, would you?
And Mr. Chair, I might add that the esteemed Mr. Gustafson is a former state representative.
And my former constituent.
Yes.
The boundaries changed.
The boundaries changed by a precinct.
So it goes with the Secretary of State. Okay. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the time. My name is Rick Gustafson. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Garden. And we're here to support House Bill 2800, which is a bill recommending the dedication of a portion of $250,000 to a concept called the Sustainable Plant Research Center. That's an effort of a series of partners, as you'll see in the testimony. I provided you with an explanation or a prospectus on the Sustainable Plant Research Center with the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, Oregon State University, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Senator Smith in February obtained a $325,000 appropriation through the Natural Resources Conservation Service to assist us in setting up this important center. The purpose behind that is really to establish and further the research in the use of plant material to solve environmental problems. We're already demonstrating most of those on our site. And our vision is to see the Oregon Garden and Oregon be the international center for how to effectively use plant materials in providing for a sustainable environment. Whether it's water uptake systems and wetlands that we perform directly with the community of Silverton, stream bank protection, it's extensive and the potential is extensive here in Oregon. And we're anxious to be a part of that, and we've been very fortunate in having strong support exhibited, and we really appreciate the positive attitude. Representative Krupp, I think, states it, but the garden can be a very key partner with these other components. And the dean of the School of Agriculture is on our board and serves on our research council, and we would urge your support and consideration of this. The issue for OWEB, obviously, and their dealings with the watershed enhancement, very critical. We think this partnership with the garden can enhance their efforts and strengthen their efforts throughout the state in addressing this important issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agriculture Alliance. We just want to support House Bill 2800. It's a fine idea, one of the original concepts of the original board put together to design the Oregon Garden was that it would someday become, to some extent, an educational research institution that cooperate with Oregon State extension and research departments in the production of research and other investigations into improving plant materials for all purposes, including sustainable environmental purposes. So we support this. There is a dash one amendment, Mr. Chairman. The dash one amendment appears to divert $250,000 from GWEB, existing GWEB revenues for this research purpose, whereas the printed form of the bill apparently takes that $250,000 from general fund. I think the dash one amendments are a good idea. That issue hasn't been discussed yet, but we support this with or without the dash one amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You support it without the dash one?
With or without.
With or without the
dash
one. And I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, I understand the dash one amendments simply change it from general fund to GWEB.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that that is the case, yes.
If anyone's in opposition to this, I think they'd be happy to have GWEB put in there. That probably would solve the opposition's problem, but...
Since it no longer exists.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, GWEB does have an existing fund stream which is intended to be used for this kind of activity, so it seemed to be a good fit. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have actually, if we could call it OWEB, because I have questions.
We're going there on the agenda. So.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you. What is Ceanothus?
It's a plant.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
How does this tie into the Department of Ag, and is this going to require resource allocation from them as far as FTE or other funds?
The Department of Agriculture is a partner. The Director of Agriculture serves on the board as an ex officio member for the Oregon Garden Foundation. They also administer the research funds that are collected through the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, and those research funds are associated with it. So the department is very closely associated with us, as well as with regard to industrial development of the growth of these products, whether it's grasses or other kinds of things, and they certainly are involved. It does not involve any financial obligations associated with the department.
Okay. We're going.
And I can confess my conflict there. I'm on the State Board of Agriculture also as vice chair.
That's so. I'm going on state here. That's obvious. We would thank you, gentlemen, for your questions. And at this point, we'd like to have Allison Hensey with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, please. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison Hensey with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. The Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board is very supportive of the Oregon Garden as a showplace for Oregon's nursery industry. In fact, we just had our most recent board meeting there on Tuesday, and it was a lovely setting.
In spite of knowing that this was coming up?
I think we send you our agenda every time.
Oh, okay. All right.
But next time I'll let you know personally.
Thank you, Alice.
However, OWEB has three concerns about this bill. First, the Oregon Garden has never applied to OWEB for funding for this project, so we haven't had a chance to look at the details of the project and have it peer-reviewed and make sure that all the right partners are involved in terms of the kind of work that we support. It's also a matter of process. In 1999, the Oregon legislature established OWEB to fund a competitive grant program that technically reviews all projects and funds those that will most effectively invest state funds in watershed restoration. OWEB staff would be happy to work with the Oregon Garden to develop a grant proposal, and Rick Gustafson and I have discussed this and plan to have a meeting about that so that we can make sure that the proposal they bring to us is within the core mission of OWEB and the Oregon Garden. Our second concern with this bill is that from the language of the bill, it's hard to tell whether the proposed project is eligible for either Measure 66 or Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery funds. Both of those fund sources have very specific mandates, and we would need to make sure that the proposal fits within those mandates. And finally, last year, OWEB adopted a list of research priorities developed by the IMST, and these are priorities that the Joint Stream Restoration and Species Recovery Committee asked the IMST to develop for the Oregon Plan in the 1999 session. We took the priorities developed by the IMST out for public comment around the state, and the board adopted those to provide a context for research proposals within the state. And I think it's important that, given this process that's been established, if this is a research proposal, that it be evaluated in the context of all other research being proposed for the Oregon Plan to make sure that state funds are spent on those research proposals that are most important to advancing salmon recovery and watershed restoration. But again, we would be very delighted to work with Oregon Garden to develop a more specific proposal for funding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I wanted to take this opportunity to agree with OWEB, and because it doesn't happen often, but
the chair wasn't going to comment on that.
I think you addressed my concerns very succinctly, and that is that we have set up a process through OWEB for grant funding. My problems with specific portions of that set aside, I think that's the appropriate way for this money to be allocated. And I think, laudable as this may be, I think it should go through the process already set up in statute. I can envision, if this goes forward, 2 years from now, having a plethora of bills introduced for direct OWEB funding for specific things that may be very laudable. And trust me, if this goes forward, I will sponsor some of those. But you know,
trust me, if this goes forward and I'm chair of the Water Committee, and where those bills will come from, my bills will go forward first.
Mr. Chair, I would have no doubt about that. But I would encourage Oregon Gardens to start working with OWEB and finding out if this research does fit in the scope. I just don't want to set this precedent of the legislator subverting the process that we've already put in place.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to note for the record that I'm in 100% agreement with Representative Cruz.
God, that scares me.
One.
Mr. Chair would like to note for the record.
Mr. Chair.
That's a rare occasion.
I am speechless. I am also in total agreement with Representative Cruz.
You're surrounded. The chair would also note for the record, not for the record, would also note that when Representative Tomei is speechless. That's a rare day.
Very rare.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not in agreement with Representative Cruz, so I'll state that for the record.
That's also a rare occasion.
It is. As a matter of fact.
I think it's because he's surrounded.
Okay. Maybe. Poor Representative Cruz. He has a tough life over there. I mean,
Mr. Chair, I'm surrounded by two beautiful women. I don't know how that could be considered to be a tough life.
In addition to which, they're very talented ladies, yes, too. So, the chair has some the concerns, and I do share some what Representative Cruz's comments about micromanaging, if you wish, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, or for that matter, any state agency. And I do have a concern about any kind of precedent that might establish. And I know we've talked on this, Allison, a little bit. The chair has concerns about whether or not Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board is devoting enough resources, of its resources, to the area of research. And I have some significant concerns about that. I am not questioning, I appreciate that you've acted on IMST's recommendation. I appreciate that you've prioritized, basically according to IMST's recommendations. But I guess my major concern is whether or not there is a sufficient allocation of resources. And I do understand, since I was part of the bill, part of the group that wrote 3225, which put all of the parameters around this after the passage of ballot measure 66, some of the constraints that we have on where we can and cannot go with money. But I really would be very interested in in a budgetary, and now I'm going to sound like Representative Krupp and sometimes Representative Cruz, I'm going to want to see some numbers from the department as to how, where our money is spent out and what portion is and where the delegation of dollars to research proposals is at.
I've brought those for you today.
Thank you, and I thought probably you had. And we appreciate that. And we'll want to have a look at those before we make a determination as to whether or not we want to amend this bill in some way or just exactly the route we would like to go with it. So.
And Chair Jensen, if I might, we've just begun discussions with Oregon State University about developing a request for proposals based on the IMST's research priorities. And so I'd like to include this committee in that discussion to make sure that the research we seek is
We would appreciate
right
that. And assure OWEB, as I know you know, there will be some type of an oversight committee, because by statute there is to be that for the agency. During the interim, and whatever that committee happens to be, we would appreciate making sure that that committee is appraised of the continued discussions that you have at OWEB on this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, barring other questions on this, we're going to close the public hearing at this time. And I'm not cutting short the questions. If anyone has questions, I certainly will entertain them.
Well, Mr. Chair, just for the record, I mean, this research is laudable and it's important and it needs to go forward, and that's not my issue.
And that's not my issue. I mean, my issue is that research needs to go forward as far as OWEB is concerned and as far as this whole area of the endangered species and recovery of salmon and whatever other species we're looking at. It's only through research that we're going to come up with viable programs or viable alternatives. So the chair is a great believer in trying to find answers when otherwise it seems like, you know, things are going to be cut from us. So one of the ways is to do this, and I think a very defensible way to do this is through some of the OWEB funding and the OWEB participation, you know, in these things. The chair would also like to note for the record that he is very supportive of the Oregon Gardens. And although he grumbled a little about it with his wife when she insisted on taking out a membership in this, not because he didn't enjoy going out to the Oregon Gardens, but because he hates to spend money. It is truly a type of thing that is an asset to us and to our state and our community, and we applaud the work that you've been doing and the work we know you're going to continue to do. But we need to look at a little other things, and I certainly need to encourage, regardless of where we go on this bill, I need to encourage the Oregon Gardens to work very carefully and closely with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and assure you that if there's ever any problem in working closely with them, that the Oversight Committee of OWEB will likely frown on that sort of thing. So, and there's no accusations or anything that, you know, with that. So with that, we're going to close for today the public hearing on House Bill 28, and we're going to recess. Yep. The Water Committee until 5 p.m. today. At 5 p.m. today, we will first hear those items that were on the agenda that we have,
wow,
that we talked about as far as the... The purpose of this is to hear or deal with those ways and means referrals. It is necessary at this stage, in order to do this the chair deems it necessary at this stage in order to do this to have the speaker's permission or okay that there is no significant fiscal. Yes, we can do it the other way at another time, but time is of the essence to us. And if we get crossways anywhere here, with the limited time that we have available, we run the risk of losing some of these things. So I want to dot the I's, cross the T's in the way that the chief clerk's office, who basically runs this institution, tells us to do it, and so therefore that's the route that we're going.
And by
thank
by
you very much for
tomorrow.
Your patience.
New meeting tomorrow.
Wait. You will also note that we have posted a new meeting tomorrow. This is a tap-tap meeting, which means it'll be very short. But it is imperative that we have a quorum. The shorter, the quicker we have the quorum, the quicker we can get through.
Representative Dingfelder will be here.
I will have expenses for tomorrow, sir.
No, you got to be here. No. No, you're a vice chair. I mean,
that's fine, Representative.
They're looking for 4 6 and 10 year bill.